Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our second look at the crimes of Gretzler and Steelman in 1973. Before we get into that, however, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just look for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. You can find me underneath one of those monikers. And if you want to interact with me, your best bet is to go to the TikTok page at Deathcast_official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app and subscribe, leave a 5-star review, and tell your friends about it. Next, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. Lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. Where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can help support this show, get access to ad-free episodes, as well as exclusive content. I recently released the third episode in the Vince McMahon saga, covering the murder of former WWF wrestler Jimmy Snuka's girlfriend Nancy Argentina and McMahon's possible involvement in covering that up. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. If you're at work, I hope this helps you get through the week. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, Douglas Gretzler and Willie Steelman, along with a young woman by the name of Marcia Renslow from Colorado, this was after Steelman's sister informed him that she was losing the house and moved out, and that he had a very short period of time to get out. The three of them set out on October 9th, going from Denver to Phoenix. On the following night, Gretzler discharged a firearm through the window of the motel they were staying in, which ended up getting them thrown out, and they were forced to spend the evening in Gretzler's car. By October 13th, they had traveled to Globe, Arizona, which is located in Gila County, sort of situated almost directly in the middle of the state. And then, as today, it was a fairly small town with only around 7,000 people calling Globe home. It was in Globe that Steelman noticed a couple who were sunbathing in the nude and decided that they needed to rob them. So, while Gretzler and Marcia Renslow waited, Steelman approached the couple brandishing a gun and took $5 from them, at which point they very quickly left Globe. Later on that day, they ended up in Tempe, Arizona, which is in Maricopa County, where the trio encountered a hitchhiker. After letting the man in the vehicle, they drove around until they found an orange grove, at which point the young man was forced from the vehicle at gunpoint, ordered to strip before being pistol whipped and robbed, specifically of a ring that was on the man's finger. Much later that evening, they arrived in Phoenix and decided that they would get a room for the night, which they did at the Stone Motel. The plan being that the following day, after they fenced the ring they had stolen from the hitchhiker, that they would drive to the address that Catherine Mestites had given to Marcia. If you'll recall, Marcia was a closeted lesbian and had feelings for Catherine. Catherine had left Denver with a 21-year-old man by the name of Kenneth Unrein. Catherine and Marcia had maintained contact with one another since Catherine had left Denver, and Marcia was given the address they were staying at, which was on 18th Street. The following morning, on the 14th, they drove to this address where they encountered Kenneth Unrein, who informed them that he and Catherine were no longer in a relationship, and it later came out that there was a violent argument between the two of them after Catherine had brought one of her clients home to service in the couple's bedroom, and Unrein had thrown Catherine into a glass door, which severely cut her hand, at which point Catherine moved out to a trailer park in Apache Junction, about 35 miles away from Phoenix. And before departing, Unrein informed the trio that Catherine was now living with a 19-year-old by the name of Robert Robbins. After this, they go and they pawn the ring that they had stolen, which gets them $60, and then they head out to Apache Junction, intent on finding Catherine. However, the address which they had been given was incorrect. It's never been stated whether this was intentional on Unrein's part or not. But the trio spent the better part of 2 days trying to track Catherine down. And when this failed to produce any leads, Steelman decided that they needed to return to Unrein's apartment. Reaching the apartment, they found Unrein in the presence of a 19-year-old by the name of Michael Adshade. After some form of an altercation, Steelman produced a gun and ordered the two men to get into the car, as they were all now going to Catherine's home. Obviously, Catherine was elated to see Marcia, and something of a party followed where quite a bit of alcohol and narcotics were consumed. Somewhere during this, Unrein and Adshade exited the apartment and headed back over to Unrein's home, presumably by hitchhiking. As you'll remember, Catherine lived in Apache Junction, which is not in Phoenix itself, but outside of it, about 35 miles. After Unrein and Michael Adshade leave the trailer, Catherine informs her guests at what had happened 2 months prior, when she had brought a client home only for Unrein to physically assault her. Want to say that we can't take Catherine Mustite's word as to what actually happened, as during this period she was an active drug user working as a prostitute. It's very likely that some form of what it was she said may have occurred, but it could be as simple as Unrein was pimping her out and didn't think she was getting him enough money and decided to teach her a lesson. fortunately, will more likely than not never know what actually happened there. In any event, after they were done with their partying, Robert Robbins drove Gretzler and Steelman back to their motel while Marcia stayed behind with Catherine. And Gretzler and Steelman, they're back in Phoenix. They're not going to remain idle. They very quickly fall back into their old habits, petty theft, and drug usage. And then things take a major turn. On October 17th, 1973, the two men decide to return to Kenneth Unrein's apartment. Arriving at the apartment, they find Unrein again in the presence of Michael Adshade. Gaining access, Steelman quickly produces a gun and forces both men to get inside of Unrein's Volkswagen van, at which point he instructs them that they're going to drive to California. It's been stated that neither Unrein or Michael were bound during this trip, although Gretzler and Steelman would alternate, with one of the men driving while the other held their passengers at gunpoint before switching off again. And it should be noted that later Gretzler would state that it was Willie Steelman who was really the leader out of the two of them, and he just simply went along with whatever it was that Steelman was wanting to do. However, we do have to take that with a grain of salt, because the things that are going to happen, Gretzler is not an innocent bystander by any means. He willingly went along with all of this, including participating in the murders. By the following morning, October 18th, they had reached Oakdale, California, where they stopped at a gas station to fuel up, and by Steelman's account, he went inside to purchase everyone beverages. After this, they drove around for hours, seemingly at random, before encountering a small town known as Knight's Ferry. This is in Stanislaus County, California, really sitting at the base of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And really, they say it's a census-designated place in California. I couldn't even find statistics or demographics as to how many people live there. It's little more than a blip situated on 100 acres of land that is most famous as a filming location for television shows such as Bonanza and Little House on the Prairie. Reaching Knight's Ferry, Steelman orders Gretzler to pull the van over next to Little John Creek, at which point the men are forced from the vehicle. Both Gretzler and Steelman said that one of the two captives, although they were never able to identify which one, asked what was going to happen now. At which point, they were bound with microphone cord and rope, with Steelman stating, "We're going to abandon you here, and you had better wait at least an hour before trying to untie yourselves." So they leave, and Unrein and Michael are left lying there, obviously terrified for what just happened, only for Gretzler and Steelman to return a few moments later. And it's at this point that things turn from a kidnapping into a straight-out murder. It's obvious that the two men had spoken at length with one another about never leaving witnesses to their crimes again. Steelman goes to Unrein and begins to strangle him. When that proves to be unsuccessful. He reveals a knife and begins to stab Unrhyme mercilessly before turning his attention to Michael Adshade, who was in the process of being murdered by Gretzler. Gretzler was having some difficulty with this. Between the two of them, they were able to take Michael Adshare's life. Now, some sources state that the pair then dragged the two victims beneath some bushes, at which point they were stripped naked and the pair fled. Others state that the bodies were actually buried in some fairly shallow graves. Mostly, this information is contained in newspaper articles of the time when Gretzler and Steelman are eventually captured and lead local law enforcement to Unrhyme and Adshade's bodies. In any event, they quickly flee the scene, heading to San Joaquin County, specifically the town of Clements, California. For those of you somewhat familiar with California, Clements is kind of in the central part of the state near Lodi. They too have a very small population. As of the last census, their population was 857. While in Clements, they visited an acquaintance of Steelman. Then they proceeded to drive off again. On October 20th, they were near Petaluma, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. If you've never heard of Petaluma, it's a fairly well-to-do city, and we are actually going to be visiting Petaluma later on this year when we cover the murder of Polly Klass. So outside of Petaluma, Unrhyme's van breaks down while they're driving along Route 1 heading north. Not long after this, they're able to get a car driven by James Fulkerson and Eileen Halleck to stop for them. And once inside the vehicle, the two men produce their gun and order the couple to drive them to Santa Clara. This was eventually changed to Marshall, California, which is really close to the coast in Marin County. Now, according to Gretzler, at this point, they bound James and placed a gun against his head, with James pleading with the two men not to hurt Eileen, saying, quote, "I know I don't have much say in this, but please don't hurt Eileen, okay? Please don't hurt her." This statement apparently really unsettled Steelman, who responded by untying James and dragging him to his feet before informing him, "I have every intention of, quote-unquote, blowing your fucking head off." It was at this point that James Fulkerson was placed into the trunk of the car, and Eileen was forced back into the back seat. It appears that they remained there for some period of time, with Steelman at one point attempting to rape Eileen. However, he was unable to maintain an erection. After this, they are kept in the custody of Gretzler and Steelman until the following morning, when driving around, the two killers see a brown Ford in a parking lot, and it's at this point that they release their captives in Mountain View and take the Ford, leaving Fulkerson and Halleck with their vehicles and obviously extremely shaken. After releasing Eileen and James, Gretzler and Steelman drove around aimlessly again, discussing what was their next move. And eventually they decided that they had already left too many witnesses, both with the young couple that they had just released, as well as those who were still in Arizona. And it was at this point that they decided to return to the Phoenix area. On October 21st, not far outside of Monterey Bay, they encountered an 18-year-old by the name of Steve Allen Loren, who was hitchhiking. They pulled over, Loren got in the car, and after speaking with them for a few minutes, it was decided that he would accompany them on the trip to Phoenix, but more than that, he would help with the expenses such as paying for gas along the way. Obviously, hearing this, Gretzler and Steelman's ears immediately perked up, and I'm sure they shared some kind of look between the two of them. Unbeknownst to Gretzler and Steelman, Catherine Mestites had purchased a plane ticket for Marcia Renslow to return to Denver, and this was because they had not seen or heard from Doug Gretzler or Willie Steelman in over 6 days. So when they did arrive at Catherine's trailer, they were dismayed to discover that she had gone back to Denver without them. Catherine asks who Steve Loren is, and they inform her that he's a friend of theirs from California. After this, they spent the rest of the day and early evening hours partying together. It's been said that Steelman began to resent Mestites' discussions of things such as astrology and white magic, as well as Steve's talk of things that didn't interest him, specifically sports. And it was because of this that Steelman decided that they were going to die. The next afternoon, October 23rd, Robbins drove Catherine Mestites to work at the Playful Kitten Massage Parlor. While they were gone, Steelman started a fight with Stephen Lowren, who was quite a bit larger than Steelman, with estimates of his height being somewhere around 6 foot, 6 foot one, and his weight being somewhere between 180 and 190 pounds. He wasn't a small man. Obviously, Stephen wins this fight, and out of embarrassment, Steelman goes and gets the shotgun and a sleeping bag, ordering Steven out of the apartment. Gretzler takes the sleeping bag from Steelman, and all of them climb inside of the Ford and drive off, stopping in a gully near the Superstition Mountains. At this point, Steelman orders Steve Lowren out of the car, demanding that he hand over his wallet, at which point the sleeping bag is either placed over Steven's head or Steven places it over his own head. They then shoot the young man in the head and leave his body before returning to Mestite's trailer. And it's interesting to note that according to Steelman and Gretzler, neither Catherine or her boyfriend ever asked them as to Steven's whereabouts. Some sources state that the following day is when Steelman convinces Doug Gretzler that they should kill Catherine and her boyfriend, although I suspect it's more likely than not that Steelman may have mentioned this to him prior to this, as we know that they drove around for a considerable period of time in California before they picked Steven up, discussing the problem that they had in Arizona in relation to the witnesses that they had left behind. However, the reason that Steelman later gave for killing the two of them was that he suspected that Robbins thought they might be responsible for the disappearance of Unrine and Adshade, as well as the fact that Robbins had a subservient relationship with Mestites. So Gretzler and Steelman decide that the next day, while Catherine is at work, they're going to kill her boyfriend. Gretzler stated that the following day, after sundown, he strangled Robbins from behind an electrical cord as Robbins was sitting in the living room. Afterwards, they shot Robbins once in the head to ensure that he was dead, and then placed his body beneath the mattress in his bedroom. It should give you some idea as to how addled everyone's minds were that when Steelman arrived at Mestite's job at the massage parlor, he was very easily able to convince her that they had driven Robbins out of town for a few days and that he had asked them to make certain that she got to work and took care of things around the house. Now again, this is according to both Gretzler and Steelman. The next day, Catherine informed them both that she was glad her former boyfriend, Ken Unrine, as well as her current boyfriend, Robert Robbins, were both out of her life, letting them know that she was now looking to score some coke. So they drove to a local store, and according to the two men, Catherine informed them that she needed to do a reading that evening in order to try and divine her future. They stated that they attempted to dissuade her from doing this, instead trying to talk her into going to work, but Catherine would not listen. And the reason that they gave for wanting her to go to work was so that they could dispose of Robin's body. However, when she refused, they waited until nightfall again, and then Steelman shot Catherine in the head as she conducted some form of a ceremony in front of an altar inside of the trailer. At this point, the two men decide that they needed to get out of Phoenix, so they head to the bus depot and catch a bus to Tucson, using money that they had stolen from Catherine to fund their trip. They end up arriving in Tucson on October 27th. Some accounts state that they ended up staying in what was called as a hippie flop house, while others that they actually found a boarding house on 4th Avenue. There is some form of altercation, and both men end up getting beaten fairly badly and losing their shotgun, although it's known that they became acquainted with their landlady's daughter, Joanne McPeak. Unbeknownst to Gretzler and Steelman, back in Phoenix, people had begun to wonder what had happened to Robert Robbins and to Catherine Stites. So somebody gains access to their trailer and their bodies are quickly discovered. Authorities are alerted, and within 24 hours of this, friends and neighbors are informing the police that there had been two shady-looking individuals around the trailer in the last few days, going by the names of Bill and Doug. They also inform them that the duo left in the early morning hours of October 26th, and that they had brought a young woman by the name of Marcia from Denver with them, who had stayed with Robbins and Catherine for about a week before heading back home. They also learned that Bill claimed to have come from California and that Doug had a New York accent, as well as the fact that both men claimed to have been heading to San Francisco. Police were pretty quickly able to determine that Marcia was Marcia Renslow. And after getting in contact with law enforcement in Denver, they attempted to persuade her to cooperate with them. However, Marcia refused until they showed her pictures from the crime scene wherein she saw Catherine's dead body. And it's at this point that Marcia decides to cooperate with the police, giving them the name of the individuals she had gone down there with as Willie Steelman. While she was not certain of Gritzler's last name, she stated that it was something along the lines of Gritzler. It was from her as well that the police learned of the other crimes that the duo had perpetrated while in Marcia's company, the various robberies and assaults. With this information, as well as locations where she believed that they had stayed, the police were able to find a receipt dated October 16th with Doug Gritzler's name on it, along with his address in the Bronx. Warrants ended up being issued on suspicion of robbery and fraud on November 1st. While they're figuring this out, the police in Phoenix get a teletype, which was a precursor to a fax, from investigators in California, specifically the Mountain View area, where they are informed that they have a abandoned green Volkswagen van that has been linked to the kidnapping of a couple in Mountain View. You recall this was James and Eileen. Arizona police are then able to trace this van back to Unrine, and they learned very quickly that the individuals who had been driving this van went by the names of Bill and Doug. Now remember what I said, Gritzler and Steelman had no idea of what was going on between the city of Phoenix and the various police departments in California. That's on November 1st. Well, that evening, the duo decide that they need to get out of Tucson. So they go about hijacking a car that belonged to a 19-year-old by the name of Gilbert Rodriguez Sierra. They approached the vehicle as he slowed at a stoplight and brandished a .22 caliber rifle that they had stolen from a nearby house. According to Gritzler, Steelman thanked Sierra for stopping before informing him, quote, "We need a ride, need a car, your car." They then force Sierra into the back seat of the car as Gritzler gets in behind the wheel and the three of them drive out of the city. There are stories out there that Steelman had claimed to various victims who had survived that he was in fact a hitman who was on the run from the police because he had quote-unquote just wasted a cop. And this is what he is purported to have told Sierra as they drove the young man away in his car. Gritzler said that he never knew for certain whether Sierra believed what Steelman was telling him, as Sierra began speaking in Spanish, something that he had not done up until this point. Steelman, at some point, orders Gritzler to pull over, and they force Sierra into the trunk of his car. They then head back to Tucson to the apartment of Joanne McPeak and her boyfriend, Michael Marsh. If you'll remember from a few moments ago, Joanne McPeak was their landlady's daughter. They end up persuading the two of them to accompany them to go purchase some pretty heavy narcotics. And as they're driving away, they inform McPeak and Marsh, quote, "We got a dude in the trunk, a narc." McPeak informs them that she doesn't believe that there's a man in the trunk, and Steelman goes through the glove box, pulling out identification for Sierra in the trunk, at which point he begins calling to Sierra in the trunk, asking him if his name is Gilbert. After receiving this confirmation, Steelman informs the two obviously terrified couple in the back seat that they're going to kill this son of a bitch, and that's a quote. Driving out into the desert, Steelman then pulls Sierra from the trunk of the car, orders him to remove his shirt. Sierra is standing there, he's petrified, and Steelman tries to shoot him. However, he had placed the t-shirt he had been given over the gun, which caused the gun to misfire. So Sierra starts running off into the desert. Eventually, Steelman pulls the shirt off the gun and shoots Sierra in the back. And in a scene right out of a movie, Sierra falls into a cactus and then rolls down into a ravine, unaware that Steelman is in hot pursuit. Steelman goes down in the ravine and shoots Sierra in the face before returning to Gretzler, McPeak, and Marsh, after which the four of them head out and purchase methamphetamine. They then go to a local drug den where they proceed to spend the evening getting high in the company of an individual by the name of Donald Scott, who they met for the first time that evening. The following day, they spend time cleaning out Sierra's car, removing any sort of evidence they can think of, and wiping it down for fingerprints before abandoning it in a parking lot. Gretzler and Steelman spend the next few days continuing to get high and staying at the apartment, unaware that roughly 12 hours after being shot, Gilbert, Sierra's body was discovered. On November 5th, they decide to hitchhike again, this time being picked up by a student at the local college by the name of Vincent Armstrong. Armstrong begins to panic as they're driving because Steelman pulls the gun out and puts it into his rib cage, forcing Steelman to hit the young man and ordering him to pull to the side of the road. Climbing into the passenger seat as Gretzler got into the driver's seat. As they're pulling away and driving off, Armstrong dives from the vehicle. Gretzler whips the car around and comes back, intent on running Benson Armstrong down. However, Armstrong is able to scale a small wall on the side of the road and avoid being hit. Armstrong ends up going to a friend's house where he's able to contact the Tucson Police Department. Initially, they're skeptical of his statements. However, going to the area that Armstrong claimed to have dove from the vehicle, they find his shattered glasses. The police then take him to a nearby hospital, and he is able to help give an identikit drawing of his assailants. While all of this is going on, Gretzler and Steelman are still out on the loose, driving around Arizona. They encounter a condominium in the Villa Parisio complex, which is near Vine Street. Driving around, they see a 28-year-old former Marine and current college student by the name of Michael Sandberg washing his car in the driveway to his home. They come upon Sandberg and force him to bring them to his home, brandishing the gun, where they encounter Patricia Sandberg, who is in the process of making food in the kitchen. Gretzler grabs a knife from a nearby rack and holds it to Patricia's throat as the duo informs the couple that they're going to be held hostage until after dusk, at which point they are going to leave them and flee the area. Michael is able to persuade the pair to allow his wife to take a Valium in order to calm her nerves. And after doing this, she makes Gretzler a sandwich, while Steelman sits and seethes, eventually seizing upon the idea that the two of them had best alter their appearances. So, Gretzler ends up dyeing his hair from blonde to brown, while Steelman shaves off his mustache and proceeds to try and disguise his black eye that he had received in the beating over at the boarding house that they had been staying at using Patricia's makeup. After this, they took clothing from the closet and dressed themselves before binding Patricia's wrists with twine, while Steelman forced Michael into the bedroom, tying him up in such a manner that the rope went around his arm, or his wrists, behind his back, down to his feet, and then up around his neck and to the headboard, meaning that if he moved in any way, he would choke himself. It's at this point that they proceed to shoot Michael in the head, before turning their attention to Patricia. They place a pillow over her head and shoot her. However, this does not have the desired effect, so they shoot her four more times. Seeing that she is still moving, Steelman then bludgeons her in the head with a golf club until she ceases moving. After this, the two men ransack the house of any valuables that they can find, clean up, attempt to destroy any evidence that might link the crime to them, before going down into the street and getting into the Sandberg's Datsun and driving back to the drug den they had been at a few nights previously, leaving the Firebird that they had stolen from Armstrong sitting nearby the condominium. Arriving at the drug den, they find Donald Scott still there, and he agrees to accompany the pair on a trip to California. They stop at a motel near Stanfield, Arizona on the evening of November 3rd, signing in as Michael Sandberg and using a check from the Sandberg's residence to pay for the room. They did this the following evening as well at a different motel. While all this is going on, the police are trying to trace the steps of Gretzler and Steelman, and they are having a very difficult time because their movements are so erratic, although that is very quickly going to change. On November 5th, they reach Pine Valley, California, where Donald Scott asks to get out as he's gone as far as he's willing to go with them. And amazingly, Gretzler and Steelman allow him to leave, dropping him close to Interstate 8. Now they head to Victor, California, which is again really in the Central Valley area of the state. And Steelman starts telling him about the owners of a market in Lodi, known as the United Market, who Steelman had had an altercation with in the past. He wanted to rob the owners, Walter and Joanne Parkin, at their residence, which was a fairly large ranch house that was fairly well secluded, surrounded by orchards and vineyards, that type of thing. And according to Steelman, he anticipated a haul for this robbery of upwards of $20,000. By the afternoon of November 6th, they had reached Lodi and spent the rest of the afternoon at a friend of Steelman's shortly before 5 p.m., Steelman convinces a friend of his to telephone his 17-year-old nephew, Gary Steelman Jr. His friend convinces the nephew that his uncle's life is in danger and convinces the young man to bring his father's handgun to the house without his father's knowledge. At this point, having received the gun, Steelman and Gretzler thank the two of them and inform them that they are going to be relieving the state. However, what they did was they drove over to the United Market. Getting there around closing time, they expected to find the husband, Walter, at the business. However, no one was there, so they drove out to the ranch where the Parkins family live. Upon arriving, they found that Walter and his wife were not there. What they discovered instead was that the Parkins' two children, 11-year-old Lisa and her 9-year-old brother Robert, were at the premises being babysat by 18-year-old Deborah Earl and her younger brother Richard, who was 15. They were able to gain entrance into the premises after Steelman convinced Deborah that he owed Walter money, at which point they brandished their guns and Steelman shouted, "Now listen, we're only here for Walter, so both of you stay cool and nobody is going to get hurt. That understood?" Gretzler and Steelman both later stated that Robert stood in shock as the two Parkins children burst into tears. Deborah went to comfort them, explaining that the couple would return in a few hours. It's at this point that they force the two sets of siblings to sit on the couch. Now, unbeknownst to Gretzler and Steelman, Deborah had gotten an uneasy feeling when they approached the house and had called her father, who immediately sped over to the property. Upon reaching the home, however, he too was taken hostage. They began questioning Deborah's father, Richard Sr., and learned that he had informed his wife that if he was not home within 15 minutes, she should call the police. So Steelman decides that they can't have this, so he instructs Gretzler to kill all of the captives if they're not back with Wanda within 20 minutes. They then proceed to leave the residence with Richard driving to the house and retrieving his wife, Steelman holding a gun on him. Afterwards, they return back to the ranch to await Walter and Joanne's return. At roughly 9:25 p.m., Deborah's fiancé, a 20-year-old man by the name of Mark Lang, arrived at the Parkin residence. He had done this by prearrangement to drive Deborah and her brother home. However, upon reaching the residence, he is taken hostage as well. So now we have two drug-addled maniacs in this house with seven people who are now held hostage, and I'm not disparaging anyone in this horrific crime, but at least to me, somebody might have had a chance to take these SOBs out. There's seven of them. However, I understand the shock and fear that these individuals were undergoing. They weren't thinking correctly, and obviously they're fearful that if they don't do what these two strange men command them to do, they're going to murder them. But to me, it's just mind-boggling to think that these two drug-addled idiots are holding seven people hostage, five of whom should be able to physically overpower them, as they only have two guns between them. Yes, someone may get shot, but since they're taking them hostage, it's obvious that these men have a plan of some sort that is not boding well for Walter. Now, roughly 10:45 p.m., Walter and Joanne Parkin return to their house. They, too, are taken hostage, and it's at this point that all of the adults are ordered to hand over any money and valuables on their persons. Joanne then begs the two men to let her put her children to bed, which Gretzler and Stillman allow. And it's at this point that everyone else is ordered into the bathroom with the exception of Walter. And as Walter is being held at gunpoint, Gretzler, using nylon cord he had found inside of the Sandberg's Dachshund, proceeds to tie the wrists of all of the captives, starting with the men and then proceeding on to the women. After this, all of the captives are marched into a walk-in closet in the master bedroom. So Gretzler is standing there, he's holding them all at gunpoint. Steelman then forces Walter to drive over to the market, where he knows there is a floor safe. Going inside, Walter opens the floor safe and hands over $4,000 before both of them return back to the ranch, and Walter joins the rest of the hostages inside of the closet. And it's at this point that all of their ankles are bound with this nylon cord. Gretzler and Steelman then went throughout the house, wiping down every surface that they had come into contact with to remove any trace of their fingerprints. According to Gretzler, he stated to Steelman, "We got what we came for, why don't we just get out of here?" To which Steelman responded, quote, "I said all along, no witnesses, I know you remember me saying it." Gretzler then goes off and shoots the two children inside of the bedroom, shot between the eyes as they slept. The hostages in the walk-in closet heard these shots, began to scream, as Gretzler and Steelman opened the door and opened fire. Richard Earl Sr. was shot first, being wounded in the temple. Gretzler then proceeded to shoot Walter Parkin, Richard Earl Jr., Wanda Earl, Deborah Earl, and Joanne Parkin. He then stops to reload his gun before shooting Mark Lang to death. Steelman then goes and shoots Richard Sr., killing him, after which he stands there and unloads his guns into the bodies of the deceased. After this, they go down into the kitchen and begin rummaging through the rest of the house. Gretzler finds a piece of chocolate birthday cake inside of the refrigerator, along with a bottle of wine, and helps himself to both, as Steelman begins to drink from a bottle of Seagram's and continues to go through the house looking for more valuables. According to both men, they left the property at approximately 1:20 a.m., checking into a nearby Holiday Inn at approximately 2:20 a.m. under the name of W.J. Seams. We are going to end the case for this week. Next week, we're going to get into the discovery of the mass murder that took place in the Parkin residence and the events that followed that. I hope you have enjoyed this second part. Again, if you did enjoy it, please consider leaving a 5-star review, going to buymeacoffee.com, making a donation, or going to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to exclusive content and episodes from the show ad-free. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasting. Stay morbid.